Thank you. All lines are now bridged.
Hey, good morning. Welcome to the meeting of the Information Blocking Task Force, Work Group 3. This is Seth Pazinski. I'll be serving as the designated federal official for Lauren Ritchie for this call. I'd like to officially call the meeting to order. So we'll start with a roll call and then turn it over to get our agenda started. So just running through the roll call, if you could mention that you're here. Andrew Truscott.
Present.
Mike Adcock.
Here.
Denise Webb.
Present.
Sasha Termet.
Here.
Lauren Thompson.
I am here.
Aaron Meary.
Good afternoon.
And any additional folks that I've missed? Okay. All right. With that, I will turn it over to Andy and Mike to lead us through our agenda.
Thanks, Seth. So, hey, guys, we're going to start off by picking up where we stopped last session on the communication section. And then we're going to go through the enforcement of all the conditions of maintenance of certification requirements, which I think is buried in there somewhere. It's not that isn't actually a subject title that I could find. So we'll have to we'll take some direction from the ONC guys on exactly what they mean by that on the agenda. Okay, so let's go to the Google Doc first. Guys, keep me on the straight and narrow. I think we were getting caught up in the non-user-facing aspects discussion.
That sounds right to me.
And helpfully, in the preamble, there was actually a definition of non-user-facing.
There was. It said it's things that are the opposite of user-facing.
I think that's what it said.
On page 193.
Yeah.
Here, I can actually...
So, the interesting piece for me in that was that the definition of user-facing says that it's manifest in how the health IT software works, which is, now Sasha, your comments around access control configuration, et cetera. By that definition, that would come under user-facing, not non-user-facing, I think.
Well, I don't know if I'm clarifying or proposing a change, but... One of the arguments that ONC puts forward in this section for permitting restricted communication about non-user-facing aspects of health IT is, twofold. One is that when it's deployed in a widespread setting, not cloistered, they call it, then it loses certain, protections that might be there. And I think they lay out a case for that. The second is that the user-facing ones are the intent of the provisions in 21st century cures in terms of permitting free-flowing communication for purposes like safety, security, and so forth. My proposal would be that administrative functionality, which is used by a much more limited set of users, right, not millions of patients or thousands of clinicians, but a smaller set of administrative users, doesn't necessarily meet the same justifications for unrestricted communication. And I would therefore propose that administrative features should be considered non-user-facing aspects. There certainly are administrative users, so the definition might need, adjusting in that sense. But I think that the arguments that ONC puts forward for why non-user-facing aspects should not be unrestricted would also apply to administrative features that have a much narrower user base.
Okay, ONC were, I think, quite, they were trying to be clear when they said evident to anyone running, using, or observing the operation of health IT. So that isn't kind of limiting it to clinical users. I see what you're saying, but I think ONC seems to be consciously saying something different.
I don't think we should just automatically assume that, because when we say anyone running, I think they're intending for the clinical functions and purposes of the health IT But again, they're not explicit about it. And so I agree with the friendly amendment that Sasha has put forth as a recommendation. Because if you're running the health IT software, that could imply administrative functions, but it's not clear if it does. And I think there's valid justification for why administrative users are not the class of users that this is concerned about in terms of unprotected, unrestricted communications.
This is Aaron. Yeah, I agree. This is Aaron. I agree. I actually agree with you. That does make sense, Sasha. You're right.
Oh, thank you, Andy. I can move my notes here. I was just, you know, we're all looking at this part of the screen because that's where the definition is. I'll move it.
Yeah.
So it looks like Aaron and Sasha and I are in agreement. What about Michael and Andy? What are your thoughts?
Oh, I'm a humble chair.
A humble chair, okay.
I am the vessel that you manifest your thoughts within.
Okay.
No one's capturing this call for some reason. Okay. Oh, I was looking forward to see that one pop up. Honestly, I don't have a problem with what Sasha suggested. I think it makes sense that administration actually be a carve-out. I've got no issues with that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm intrigued as to why it was deliberately drafted like this and whether it was poor draftsmanship or whether there was a conscious desire to include these kinds of activities or not.
It's an interesting question, and maybe ONC can shed some light. Because they describe one of the rationales for including user-facing aspects as having like large groups of users, I kind of suspect they were not thinking about the fact that some features could have much more narrow sets of users, like administrative features, maybe an oversight in that sense.
It's a fairly massive oversight. ONC, can you shed light on that? Mark?
Hey, Penelope, do you have any thoughts on this one?
No, not really. Just that in general, I think it, at the very beginning, we talked about in the preamble that we proposed to broadly interpret, you know, these subject matters and the type of conduct. So, but I don't have any particular familiarity with this section right here.
Okay.
It's probably valid to bring this forth to the full task force as a suggested recommendation and take it from there as a draft recommendation.
Yeah, I think in general, this is Aaron, I think in general, I appreciate Sasha's approach of trying to pragmatically, you know, identify what, like, not look at everything in holistic as the same, because it's not. If you look at it from a programmatic perspective, there is a distinct difference between administrative controls and, you know, clinical workflows and all sorts of things within an application or system or product. So I think that's a very good hierarchy and structural at everything that we look, every recommendation. How do we specify appropriately? Because each of the control features that a developer may need to build in will be different depending on the section and the users. So it totally makes sense.
Well, and you can note it on the Google Doc. We'll look into it and try to give some background next call.
Okay, I'll put in a note. ONC question.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Sasha. Okay, I'm sure this will be a discussion which has no conversation at all. Intellectual property. Sasha finished typing.
I think what I've been struggling with in the intellectual property provision, I guess first off, I think it's an important recognition that HIT developers and others have important intellectual property investments in health IT, right? Both the HIT developer and their investments in the research and development of the software, but then also others, you know, content providers, for example, their intellectual property might also be part of health IT. And protecting all of that is important. It's kind of critical to the ongoing innovation and investment in the market. And so I think that the tricky part I have with these provisions is how to balance the proposed distribution of information for what are purposes that clearly have the public good in mind, safety, security, improved usability of products, and so forth, with the risk that widespread disclosure of intellectual property, and I think this partly gets into some of the questions about screenshots, because I think design is something that developers invest heavily in, could be used for nefarious purposes as well as the public good purposes. So how do we balance the sort of public good purposes with the risk of a nefarious actor who really wants to copy the system and distribute it as their own work when it wasn't really theirs to start with?
So,
and I
Sasha,
think it's a tough balance to make, right?
Yeah, you're right. Sasha, can I give you a real-world example as a CIO, something I struggle with one of my vendors, and then maybe we could use that as a dovetail and to talk about how we could find a middle ground. So in one of my prior lives, we were doing coordination around specialty care and being able to extend perhaps our EMR capabilities to partner with a sister hospital in China. And we were trying to figure out, could we extend care and or via telemedicine and also the medical records so that we could obviously, you know, get the clinical diagnoses, all that within our medical record without a problem. In those discussions, the vendor we were working with said, no, you're not allowed to share information, particularly with any external parties, of screenshots or whatnot. And so we were kind of dead in the water, because we could talk about, hey, it would be great to share HMPs. It would be great to share clinical diagnoses, maybe PACS images, whatnot, as we're trying to see, you know, patients remotely. But because we were unable to share any kind of screenshots or visualization or even kind of do like a WebEx with them, it really shot the whole thing down and the entire project fell apart. Thus, it kind of limited the ability for us to deliver care with a sister hospital in China. So neither here nor there. That was several years ago. But it really begs the question as to what is the middle ground? Because I appreciate your point. I completely agree that you do have to give protections to the developer community and making sure things like, to your point, workflows and layout and UX are protected. But yet, how do we not inhibit me as a hospital from partnering and extending care to this part, in this case, a country who was desperately asking for it because they have a massive issue of obesity and needing specialists? What's the middle ground there? How am I able to work through that, being that we're, you know, a lot, in some cases, really restricted today? What do you think?
Yeah. Well, and I think in some cases we need to differentiate where sharing the data is important versus sharing the design of the health IT, right?
Mm-hmm. So perhaps the suggestion could be to that, based on scenario, based on is it for treatment and care purposes versus generally sharing? Is that what you're asking?
Well, it seems to me that in most cases, when you're sharing for treatment and care purposes, what you're really interested in sharing is the health information contained within the health IT, not the actual design of the health IT, right?
Well,
yes, what do you mean when you say design?
Years that are called out as different for sharing information about the design of the health IT are for other purposes, not treatment, right? They're for purposes
right.
Like usability analysis.
Sasha, can you define what you mean by design, please?
Sure. So I guess, like, if you were sharing information for treatment, what you want is the content of a note, as an example, not the layout that one system might use for writing a note and the tools that might be available to users of that system. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand your point, but I know full well that, you know, it's very often I've seen notes which have been shared between physicians, which are actually a screenshot.
Well, Sasha, I can appreciate your perspective. So let me go back to my scenario for a second. In the case of what we were trying to do, it really was trying to get two systems to talk to each other, and or we would extend our EMR via Citrix or whatever else, so folks could log in and input the information as if they were sitting in our clinic. Again, the whole point of sort of that telemedicine, telespecialty. So to the degree of it, it would have been difficult for us, and in this case also with a language barrier, to work through this just a basic structural note or whatever else without talking in some sense about here's how you would enter a note, here's how you would enter something in. You know what I mean? It would take away from a lot of the discussion. So I kind of go back to, is there a scenario basis here that we could consider and work through to allow for the community to openly have these discussions and advance care and advance the delivery of care across the country and across the world? I guess that's what I boiled down to question-wise.
Sure. And I think one of the concerns is that when the health information, I think everyone is in agreement that the health information needs to follow the patient for their treatment. I think the question of whether the design of the software, which in many cases represents a lot of research and development effort from health IT developers, is necessary is one where we have to balance the risk of impeding treatment, which of course is no one's goal, right? Everyone wants to facilitate that, with the risk of if the intellectual property protections are not afforded to health IT developers and their intellectual property is vulnerable to theft and copying by, you know, nefarious actors who don't respect U.S. property, intellectual property considerations, then that has a consequence on the whole industry, right? Because it discourages any further investment in the type of design and intellectual property that we're talking about.
Right.
So in that scenario, I guess the question is, how do we allow the types of projects that you're talking about to proceed while ensuring that doing that project doesn't inadvertently jeopardize and allow someone to copy the system as part of that access? Is there a way to protect that?
Mm-hmm. And I completely agree with you, and I completely appreciate, again, having built product in my most recent life before this one, I get it, right? I totally get it.
Sure.
I guess I go back to, do we need to approach healthcare scenarios with, I'm going to use your word here, the nefarious potential, or should we approach it where me as a hospital system, if you want to accept responsibility for this, and if your other party steals our design, well, then you're culpable for that. I mean, there may be a way to offer an ability, because I was totally shut down by my vendor. They were like, no, absolutely not. And I mean, the condition was real. The situation was real. I had no reason to believe there was nefarious intent. I don't think hospitals enter into these discussions thinking the other party's a nefarious intent. But because of that, the whole thing collapsed.
Your proposal would be that the discloser of the intellectual property would then be liable for potential loss?
As a potential scenario, yes. In that case, is that something we want to propose? I'm just talking out loud here. That would maybe, it may have been an acceptable compromise, right? Instead of the flat, no, you're not allowed to do anything.
This is Denise. I just have a question for Aaron and Sasha. So the scenario that Aaron described was one hospital speaking to another hospital. Neither were health IT vendors.
Correct.
And so I could understand, Sasha, if you're going to do a webinar and show screenshots minus your, you know, EHI, that's for confidentiality reasons, protecting the privacy, but that you would show screenshots to show how you do something in particular, let's say at your hospital, and how you might leverage that in the sister hospital that doesn't currently use that software. I'm trying to understand what motive they would have for stealing the design of a screen design.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know
if
that
it was
they
a vendor,
right?
I guess I could see. I mean,
I think the tricky
like,
part.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, when I think about having been a CIO, and if I'm going to go out and look at different products and what might work best for us, I would expect that fellow CIOs who are using these other products could share information about the product and actually let me see the product without the vendor being involved. It's not my purpose is not to look at the product so I can feel the design of the screen, of the user interface.
And I think that maybe this sense of purpose is important to what ONC is trying to put forward. There's like a whole spectrum of possible purposes, many of which are not even remotely nefarious, and others are more suspect, right? So to put something else on the spectrum, we have folks who will come up to our booth at HIMSS and be like, hello, we'd like to record a demo of all your software because we're developers and we'd like to make something exactly like it. That is, you know, a different
place
on the
spectrum,
that's
right? Shady. Yeah, that's just shady, right?
And so I guess the question is, how do we know the purpose for some sort of disclosure that includes intellectual property of the health IT developer, and then ensure that when a disclosure happens for a good reason, that there's not re-disclosure for a nefarious reason, right? So if your disclosure is to another CIO, as in Denise's example, I agree. You know, CIOs should be able to go around and look at other facilities and see how their HIT works and use that to inform purchasing decisions and other roles. I think the tricky part is that if your disclosure is to, like, Twitter, then the possibility of the purpose of the initial disclosure could be one of the ones in 21st Century Cures. The sort of secondary use of that, though, could be one of the nefarious actors that's like, oh, I'm going to use this to make a copy of that. And so what I'm trying to figure out is how do we take that element of purpose, which it sounds like all of us are coming back to, and say the purpose of this is important, and whether or not the disclosure is restricted seems to hinge on what the purpose of it is, and maybe also an element of redisclosure also hinging on the purpose of that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and so maybe we take the approach that ONC did with information blocking and state what, you know, what the positives are versus all the negatives. So we could give purpose of, to your point, I just use the word purpose of disclosure, in which case we assume good intent, right? And then anything else outside of that is ill intent. So in this case, one hospital talking to another hospital is good intent. One hospital talking to vendor ABC about vendor XYZ, there potentially could be question mark. Just an idea.
Sure. I'm just trying to jot down some of what we're talking about so we don't forget it later.
I have to briefly step away. I'll be right back.
Thanks. So I think as we're looking at this intellectual property clause, we ought to, you know, seeing as C2 refers you to D, the screenshot section below, we ought to kind of look at them in conjunction with each other. And in going through the preamble is pretty explicit. There's no intention here to infringe upon legitimate intellectual property concerns. And, you know, this condition of certification is not intended to operate as a de facto license for health IT users to act in any way that might infringe legitimate intellectual property rights of developers. Okay, so we've got that. Do we think that this text, you know, to channel my inner Arya Malek, if it's not in the regs, it's not in the regs. So do we think that this regulation as it's currently drafted reflects that appropriately or not?
Could you restate that question? Sorry.
Okay. Do we think that the regulation as currently drafted, C1 basically, C and C1, reflects the preamble as it's currently drafted, that, and I quote directly, this condition of certification is not intended to operate as a de facto license for health IT users and others to act in any way that might infringe the legitimate intellectual property rights of developers?
I think the element of purpose that we've been discussing is not reflected in the regulatory text.
Doesn't that come under fair use?
So are you speaking of C1, Andy?
Yeah.
That would cover what Sasha's concerned about or doesn't cover?
So you're saying
and what
that
would be
if the purpose were nefarious, it wouldn't be a fair use, and if the purpose were, you know, show a fellow CIO how it works, that would be a fair use.
Correct.
Fair use is a legal term, and I would have to brush up on exactly what that meant to weigh in on if that would sort of jive. Let me put a note.
Okay. I'm sure that ONC had lawyers advise on this, but actually, ONC people, would you like to comment on this?
Yeah, I mean, this is another one I'm happy to look into as far as background goes, but I believe we did have legal folks looking.
Okay. It'll be, I can't see any examples of fair use, particularly in
the... Yeah, I think
Yeah.
I think we need more explanation of what the legal definition of fair use is and what are some examples. Because I know in the educational world, there's this concept of fair use of copyright work that to deliver education, it's not something you're disseminating to make a profit or to compete.
The standard definition is you can use something for criticism, news reporting, teaching, and research. That's the fair use doctrine in U.S. law, anyway. I'm just brushing off my LLM days.
So would it be helpful to communicate to the legal team and ONC that we're trying to capture the concept of purpose and kind of get their thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think Mark, did you pick that one up?
Yes, I see Sasha's noting it, and if you can note the fair use specifically, just so I, my memory, that'd be great.
Cool. Yeah, there's a curious lack of examples in the preamble compared to other sections which are exhaustive in their examples. And so C2, shall I propose we park this one till we've had some feedback from ONC over fair use and their intent there?
Yeah, and then I guess
Maybe
that feeds into a question about D, which is I'm wondering if fair use would also have a volume component, because sort of like thinking of the scenario of like doing a usability study with 12 screenshots is different than I'm going to take 1,000 screenshots for the purpose of copying something. And hopefully that fair use definition might accommodate that concern of mine as well.
Let's find out.
Okay.
I have an opinion, but it's probably not worth expressing at this point. Let's find out what they say. But the screenshots here is a deliberate carve-out. So it sounds, if I just look at the wording, a health IT developer may require persons who communicate screenshots. So this seems to be embracing the fact that people communicate screenshots. Now, in your...
Well, that's in C2,
points,
right?
Yeah, that's in D1. Oh,
well,
yeah.
C2 says screenshots
and
are allowed,
yeah.
And then D1 says you can restrict screenshot communication by saying you can't alter it, right?
Yeah, you can't alter them, you can't infringe IP, etc. Now, do you, just in your day job, do you treat screenshots as IP? Because your comments around layout would make me think you do.
Yes, screen design is important to us.
Okay, so... But this seems to be clearly saying
or no, this seems to be saying, not clearly, otherwise we wouldn't be discussing it, it seems to be saying that screenshots actually are not IP, or at least a screenshot isn't, at least on prima facie evidence.
Yes, I think the argument is that the use of screenshots for some of the purposes that are described, ONC says, would be fair use and should not be restricted because it's important to the goals of 21st century carriers of communication on those key topics. And ONC makes the case that it should pose minimal impact to intellectual property. I guess I worry that they are underestimating the value of knowing that type of design and the impact.
And when I look at D3, and in your favor, when I look at D3, it says, would that protect the information if there is a consent? Okay, if there is a consent, what's the point in sharing the screenshot?
Well, D3 is about redacting PHI, not
unless
intellectual property, right?
No, no, but D3 is a subset of D, okay?
Yep.
So the health IT developer can require persons to communicate screenshots to redact protected health information unless consent's been provided. Okay, in which case, if there's no consent, does that mean I can communicate the screenshot and disclose your layout? Is that not IP?
I think that's what's proposed. They're proposing that you could require the PHI to be redacted, like blurred or whatever, because you're not supposed to disclose PHI under HIPAA without authorization, but that the screenshot could still be disclosed. This is removing that opportunity to, I guess, protect designs in that way.
Yeah, so it seems to me that ONC is saying a layout is not intellectual property.
They seem to be saying that, yes.
Okay, we're in agreement, at least on the understanding of what they seem to be saying. Mark, can we get clarification to confirm that? Because I think it's fairly obvious that layouts are seen by many, many organizations as being, you know, part of their intellectual property because they've spent a lot of time, effort, researching and performing the correct UX design that they require, and that could be considered IP.
Sure. I don't want to speak out of turn, but I'm happy to look into it. So if you can, again, Sasha, if you want to just note it, I'll add it to the list, and I'll report back.
Sasha's on scribe mode today.
I try to take good notes.
Yeah, I'm putting her to work. Thanks, Sasha.
Okay. Mike, have you got any thoughts on this, given, you know, you've been very quiet, and given your background working with multiple vendors?
No, I think, yes, I have been very quiet. I've been enjoying the conversation. I think that the vendors that I've come in contact with have pretty much seen it along the same line that screenshots were seen as intellectual property, that screen design and the aspects of screen design were something that they spent a lot of time focusing on. I will say that as someone who has tried to connect with multiple different sites with multiple different areas, someone that has been involved with trying to create similar flow at other institutions who maybe just have acquired the same software or on a different software, it poses challenges, but I certainly understand where the health IT companies are coming from that standpoint. I think that there has to be some way to, and I agree, intent and what we're trying to accomplish in this communication is extremely important. I think as long as we're talking about a healthcare entity to a healthcare entity, not some type of vendor or other type of actor, I think that we should give a lot of credence to that fact that if it's between two healthcare entities, the act is in all likelihood not nefarious, and we need to be as open as we possibly can.
Yeah, I'm I hear you.
I don't know.
Well, so I'm kind of thinking about it. It's almost like you almost want to say something like, and Sasha, chip in, a screenshot communication is fine if it contains PHI, has been consented to by the patient,
and is being shared from healthcare professional to healthcare professional for the purpose of providing care.
I would certainly agree that it's fine in those cases, I guess with one caveat that in many healthcare organizations, people don't want to share PHI by taking screenshots because it circumvents the usual practices of having to record a disclosure. So when you share information about a patient, you need to log a disclosure so that the patient can be provided an accounting of their disclosures under HIPAA. And other mechanisms for sharing patient information, like printing, faxing, sending information interoperably between systems, would often automatically log a disclosure. If a provider circumvents that by just taking a screenshot, they would have to manually log the disclosure, and it seems likely that they would forget to do that and end up in trouble with their HIPAA obligations.
Actually, we've got clients who do, and they have specific systems to allow that, but you make a valid point. It's not ubiquitously the case, but some do and some don't.
Sure.
Yeah. Has Aaron returned to us yet?
Before we proceed, this is Denise.
Hello.
As I'm listening to all of this and thinking about it, I know just from my experience that most of these user interfaces are tend to be configurable, or these screens, depending on the workflow and the particular specialty. At least from some of the products I've seen. And, I do know that this idea about healthcare provider to healthcare provider, particularly if you're a CIO and you are not supporting just one EHR, but you want to implement a particular workflow in a similar way with the two products you have through configuration, that's not infringing on intellectual property rights. That's more tailoring the configurable features of a product so that they're similar in workflow and steps. I really do think this idea about between healthcare entities or trying to configure products so that they're similarly working similarly to support a workflow is different than copying somebody's work or design. So that would just be my comment on this.
I agree. I'm thinking this way.
Yeah, and it may involve, it may involve, particularly if you have a vendor supporting the use of their health IT, that they may be involved in this communication. So let's say you have EHR A and EHR B, and there's a particular workflow for a lab collect specimen, and you want to have it similarly situated and configured in your two different EHRs. You have a health IT vendor of one EHR, supporting you and telling you how you can do that in their particular configuration. I mean, would that constitute copying or stealing intellectual property? I don't think so, but I don't know, Sasha, can you comment on a scenario like that, how you would see that?
I think that would pose very minimal risk to intellectual property. The only concern would be if it was communicated in a way where it were redisclosed for another purpose, right? Like the healthcare provider users are not trying to copy the system. They're just trying to optimize their configuration. And
mm-hmm.
I don't think that's, I think most health IT developers would encourage that.
Right. Now,
well,
on the other hand,
these rules touch everybody equally. Sorry, Denise, go on, carry on.
No, I was just going to say, on the other hand, then if the health IT vendor of but one product was to then go take what they saw and learned and then go change their software to mirror the other health IT vendor's product, then that would be infringing on intellectual property.
Right. I think the provider users are a different maybe case than the developer users. Of course, there's tricky mm-hmm. scenarios where providers and developers are the same entities.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, we're working on rules here which touch everybody equally, regardless of intent or motivation. And creating rules which address the nefarious versus creating rules that affect the godly or vice versa is a dangerous place to be. So I'm not sure that's a helpful comment, more that these rules are tricky to work through because they touch everybody equally.
I agree, and I think it's hard to draw lines around the behavior that seems to be intended by 21st century cures and behavior that I think we all agree was not really what was intended. How do we make that distinction so that it would be kind of draw that line that you mentioned?
Yeah.
And that may be our recommendation, that they need to make a clearer distinction in the regulation.
Yeah, we've made lots of comments about purpose. I think maybe that the purpose of the use needs to come into play. And
right.
depending on what they come back with in terms of the definition around fair use, we might want to be a bit stricter than just saying fair use. Fair use feels like it might be a bit of a broad brushstroke that's been applied, potentially. Let's look and see what they come back with.
Okay, I tried to capture that.
You did a good job. You're better than the capture people at my accent.
I could try to put some British spelling in there. Maybe there's like some words that need extra use.
I think if you'll just put in all around most of what he says, it'll be fine.
Just make sure everything's got an S rather than a Z. I'll be happy. Okay. I think we've probably exhausted D as far as we can for the time being. Would you guys agree?
So the one thing that I guess I would raise about D, which is that so a developer can restrict, like the scenario as I understand it under D2I, is that if a health IT product contained other IP, say an assessment scale or certain content or images
yep.
that were licensed for drawing on medical figures, that the developer could say, actually, you don't have the right to disclose that other content for this purpose. If all reasonable endeavors to secure a license and sublicense were pursued, it seems odd to me to put, I guess, thinking as a developer, the developer then has to basically either remove content that they can't pursue that license for or pay more for the content if the developer of the scale or the image or whatever it is, the content provider says, gosh, well, if my content is going to be at higher risk to be exposed, I want more for it.
I must confess, I read 2I, and I thought it was saying, provided you've taken all reasonable endeavors to secure a license, it's okay.
So if you say,
it doesn't, it
would
doesn't
you
say
amend
if
your
they
license?
Say no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that a legal definition of all reasonable endeavors? Is asking sufficient?
Well, it doesn't say best endeavors, does it?
I'll just put in a comment so we can check on that.
Yeah. I thought about it, but they said I thought they might say no, so I didn't. That doesn't seem to pass the reasonableness test.
Yeah, I think the other component of that is that D2III seems to underestimate the complexity of doing this. When I think about trying to identify every aspect of a screen that might contain third-party content, especially when that's massively configurable, and could include all sorts of code sets and so forth.
Really? As a developer, you know what third parties you're using their you're using within your platform.
Sure. So is the notice in D2III like if you incorporate these codes into the system at all, then they might be on your screens and you shouldn't redisclose that without permission from the code set provider? Or is it on this screen, you might see this code if the patient had that particular condition, or you might see this other code, or you might see an image if the patient had ever had an image in a past visit annotated, or you might see this content if you happen to have a reference incorporated into a note. Do you see what I'm saying?
Okay, so I understand exactly what you're saying. So my interpretation of this particular clause was that where you've got third-party software embedded inside your software, you would notify that third party that if your software, a screenshot, gets shared, it may include theirs. And that's it. End of. I didn't anticipate, well, I don't think code sets is a good discussion point given the way that they're licensed. But, certainly in terms of like visuals, tooling, et cetera. Yeah.
But Andy, this is saying that the developer has to put all potential communicators of that screenshot on sufficient written notice.
I'm misreading it. Thank you.
Not the third party. So I think there is two versions of this. Is it just to put them on notice that here are the third party code sets and things that we use that may appear in screenshots, and you need to be aware of it. And if they appear in the screenshot, not go by each screen. I mean, that would be an onerous burden.
So I'm not even sure.
So we should just have this clarified that this is not per screen, because it says sufficient written notice of each aspect of its screen display. Well, there could be thousands of screens with thousands of aspects.
Sasha, I apologize for saying, I don't think this is so bad. I understand I misread the communicators bit on the top line of it. I agree with you. I'm not even sure technically how it's possible, because you capture screenshots, you know, outside of the EMR. You capture screenshots, you know, using your desktop snipper. So copy it to the local buffer and then paste it into wherever you're going to paste it. I'm not even sure it's possible, because every screen is going to have a different definition of potential third party, unless on every single screen you put this might well contain third party. But then this actually says sufficient written notice of each aspect of a screen display that contains third party content. That seems unnecessarily harsh.
I'm glad that I guess I wish I had been misreading it, but I'm glad I wasn't misunderstanding the consequence. I don't know how I would be possible realistically. I think you could potentially identify the types of third-party content that could be in an EHR or that are incorporated by the developer themselves, but that would be like a one-time identification to the healthcare system, not like a warning on every single screen that someone might look at, because that would just clutter the screen display in a way. Well, one, it would be too cluttering. And then two, I don't know how with the configurability of systems that you would even know on a particular screen what the content was. It could depend on like what someone had put in a previous note for that patient.
So, Sasha, I think the recommendation here is that this should be referring to a notice of the third-party products that are protected that could appear where their information may appear in a screen. But enumerating per screen, per aspect, is, I think, unrealistic.
It's heavy. And you've got the term in here on sufficient, because normally the way that people would say there's going to be third-party content inside their product is on the splash screen at the front end, which, yes,
right.
Not many people read ever.
And then so
when it says sufficient written notice, it doesn't tell you how you have to give that notice. So
no, but sufficient is a very strong term. Sufficient to whom? Sufficient though the that you know that
that's
the reader has understood. Yeah, it's highly subjective.
Yeah, how many people click through those? Yep, I read all the terms and conditions. Click.
I tell you what, I'm assuming you have Outlook, okay? How many third-party products are inside Outlook? You never read it, do you? But none of us do.
You don't know.
That's probably got Apple or something. But yeah,
I use Outlook.
But it's yeah, but none of us, you know, there's lots of third-party software inside Outlook and you know many other products, commercial products out there. That most. Everything depends upon a library. Okay, I'm kind of feeling I have difficulty with this.
Yeah,
with
so if
the
you look
proposal
at the...
or with the existing language? I tried to put the proposal that Denise suggested of a list of which content might appear.
Yeah, and then that way they can exercise sub 4 there. The communicators can communicate the screenshot after they've redacted the third-party content.
Right.
So if they're given a general list of, you know, if these things appear in the screenshots, these are third-party. It doesn't not by screenshot by aspect.
Denise, let's just think that through, you know, in a realist world situation. If I'm a physician sitting there and I've got my EMR open, and I'm just going to take a screenshot of this and share it with somebody, where am I going to be told that there's third-party content on this screen?
That's a good point.
Well, let's think about, I guess, kind of playing out that example, right? So,
yeah. Test it.
The, I guess, question of, for, I guess the first question is, how might third-party content be part of that screen, right? If you think of the screen, there could be content that's incorporated by the developer and sort of part of the architecture or the Chrome of the system, right, which the developer would know about and know which screens it appears on. And then there could be third-party content that's available, like, as reference materials for a clinician, and the locations of that would presumably be known. But then I think more challenging from a sort of know-it's-there perspective would be third-party content that's incorporated into a patient's record. So if there are specific images or assessment scales or tools of that nature that are in the patient's record that are licensed for the purpose of treatment but not licensed for the purpose of redisclosure for these other reasons, how would you know that, like, oh, I can use this pain scale for treatment purposes, but I'm not allowed to redisclose this pain scale and, you know, share it for purposes of comparative usability evaluation or whatever the other purpose would be, right? And I
no,
think
I
the tricky part
let's
is that,
go.
Oh, the tricky part is that the developer would know some types of third-party content that would or could be in the software, but they won't necessarily know every screen that it appears on because of the variability of configuration at the healthcare system or of just the variability of a particular patient's chart.
Yes, and many EMRs are designed to have that level of flexibility that, you know, the developer won't have any idea, especially when you get into some of the, you know, portal-type technologies as well, which
right.
by their very inherent nature work upon portlets, which are highly configurable, and you can use third-party portlets as much as you like.
Right.
You know, I must admit, I think, yeah, one aspect you talked about there was third-party content. So there's, you know, let's say you've got a screenshot that has some, I don't know, something from medical literature that's actually put in there as well that's come from one of the MedPub. Well, actually, there's a license from MedPub, but that doesn't give you a distribution license, but there's actually, you know, a snippet on there from literature. The same goes if you're using Discover or something like that to actually source medical knowledge and maybe mortality rates or something like that with a particular condition. That's third-party content. And then you've also got third-party... Oh, go on, Denise.
I was going to say, well, yeah, like how about CPT codes? Aren't those licensed?
Yes.
Yeah, but yeah, they're licensed for everyone, right?
For
specific purposes, right?
Yep.
Yeah, for specific purposes.
Yeah, something like SnowMed is covered by...
This is like opening a can of worms, I'll tell you.
Well, I'll tell you the other aspect I was thinking. Let's say that there's, and it kind of plays into the portlet stuff, but also with something like a Smart on Fire app, okay? They're designed to be renderable inside other EMRs. That's what Smart's there for. So you've got the masterful Vital Signs app, which is used by lots and lots of people, and it's appearing as a Smart on Fire thing inside your EMR as a little widget. And you don't know that's a widget. You're just a, you know, I'm just a physician trying to get on in the world. I'm kind of talking around the same point of saying this is really difficult.
I think ONC is going to need to revisit this.
Just for clarity, hi, this is Mark. When you say this specific topic,
D23.
And even D24 would be difficult if people don't know what they're looking at has third-party content, like a physician.
Yes. Yeah.
It's just, this is so wide and deep.
It seems highly aspirational.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's going to tell me that, oh, I'm sure machine learning can do this. And I'll be like, Sasha, have you guys ever, you know, in your day job, ever done anything to look into whether this is possible or not?
To look into, like, identifying third-party content in the system?
Yeah, or whether there's any way of there are ways of programmatically stopping your UI from being captured if there's a snippet going on. But do you guys do that? Is that possible in how you built your UI?
No, we don't like disable Windows features for screen clipping.
Okay. There are ways. This is putting a fairly substantial burden on developers, I think, is the point.
Yes, I think my worry is that if this were enforced, the effective consequence would be have to remove third-party content. And then the third-party content would all have to be incorporated by the healthcare provider, which has its own sort of downstream burdens. But, I mean, realistically, that's, I think, the way people would have to approach it.
Yep. The law of unintended consequences.
Right.
Okay, so we want a D3.
We kind of talked about D3 earlier. I don't know that we had any comments. At least I didn't write any down.
No.
I think it's fine. I mean, I think that's
sense.
Pretty standard.
Yeah. I agree. I think it.
Okay. Makes sense. That's HIPAA, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. E. Market testing and development.
So this section, in the preamble, ONC talks about how they recognize that as part of the pre-market development process, people might want to share designs, future ideas, strategic directions, potential software prototypes, and so forth with their clients or with others who are advising them on the design and get feedback with a greater expectation of confidentiality than might be permitted by the earlier provisions once something is in widespread deployment. And they recognized, I think correctly, that if you couldn't do that, it would impede the ability to get valuable user feedback during the design process, which is, of course, an important feature of user-centered design. So this is allowing restrictions on communications that are about pre-release software.
Yeah, but isn't this clause saying that those extra restrictions, for want of a better term, would automatically drop once the software has actually been released?
Yes, that's my understanding. So if you were developing feature X, and you know, I might share it with you, Andy, saying, "Hey, this is pre-release. Please keep it confidential." And then if feature X launched next month, at that point, it would no longer be considered confidential.
Yep, that's what I'm saying too. And you're more than welcome to share feature X with me.
And then on page 200 near the bottom, they are asking specific comment on should there be a time limit on how long something can be out in beta release and or specific parameters for covered testing. And I think getting into all of that is getting way too prescriptive. You know, how many vendors leave something in beta for an incredibly long time? And even if they did leave it in beta and it's only affecting one client or two clients, that's not a large population to warrant, you know, that unrestricted communication.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think we should be getting into trying to be. I see they're trying to be helpful, but the fact is, you know, in this space, the time to bring a product to market can take a very long time.
Yeah, and then sometimes it might not ever come to market because it just things change in the landscape.
Some products are very quick. Yeah. I don't think we're gonna try and say, okay, well, some products are going quick and some will go slow. These are the types of ones that can go quick. No, it seems to be an unnecessary overreach.
Yeah, and if there was something in beta and you're not going to bring it to market, but you have a client that worked with you on it and still wants to use it, I mean, you might make some arrangement with them to allow them to have it. But
in beta,
I don't think they should get into setting time periods and all this, because you know that's assuming that somebody would really want to abuse this prohibition or restriction.
Sorry, so 2.2.E. You got that, Sasha?
I think.
Oh, she's there. Yeah.
And I think that's the last communication piece, isn't it? Regulation text. Oh, and then there's maintenance of certification.
Yeah, that's the end of E. I think we're all kind of like okay on E, beyond the bit that you just outlined, Denise.
Right, and then this last part of the regulatory text is around maintenance of the certification.
It is,
which that would really be kind of what does Sasha think about the 6 months?
Yeah, so. I think the effort that would go into this is dramatically underestimated by ONC. They estimate that the, notice provisions in one would take each developer 40 hours of work, which would be an office clerk paid $15.87 an hour. And then they estimate that in two, they don't estimate any effort for that because they say that they think that amending contracts would be accomplished in the normal course of business. And so to me, the timeframes and the work here are certainly going to represent more than 40 hours of an office clerk. There's probably a fair amount of work from other roles, right? Like attorneys who draft contracts or amendments, not just office clerks. And then also work from the recipients of these. So the you know, what do the third-party content providers think when they're sent this reasonable notice that their content might now be disclosed for more purposes? Will they want to talk about that? Will they want to try to negotiate changes to that provision? What will the customers think? This should theoretically be more permissive for customers, so hopefully they would understand that. But in my experience, many of them might want to ask questions, even if that's, you know, it's from that perspective. And so I think that all of this section is, you know, very dramatically underestimated in terms of what it would actually mean for health IT developers, especially as you play through the implications for, like, notices to third-party content providers and if that content needs to be then removed from the system and all of those kinds of provisions.
So would our recommendation be that they need to revise their estimates? Because I don't disagree with you, Sasha, because I was involved in a number of notices, like when I was in my former role and we shut down the IT company, we had to make a number of notifications to entities we had contracts with. It wasn't for this purpose, but to then say now this contract is being assigned to the health system. So that did involve more than just the contract specialists. They weren't clerks. They were contract specialists that did those notices. I guess their salaries or their pay is probably around the rate that was estimated in here. But it did involve attorneys. It did involve people at the VP level. It involved the parties on the other side who had to receive the information and acknowledge it and accept it. So, yeah, I would say that they've underestimated the cost related to this.
So what about the time frames? Do you have thoughts on what would be reasonable time frames, or are you suggesting they shouldn't include time frames at all?
So one of the questions, I guess, would be what is involved in these time frames? If this is this just about notice and contracting, or is this about the earlier provisions? So, for example, if this time frame includes the activity we talked about earlier as being potentially infeasible, like determining screen by screen which elements might be under a different intellectual property license of a third party, or removing content from the system because it's unable to come to terms with the third party who holds that copyright license for redisclosure for these purposes, some of those pieces would dramatically change my assessment of what time frame is feasible.
Sasha, I think this is just referring to the notice that these communications that are allowed by these communicators,
okay,
these protected communications, that if there's something in their contracts that says otherwise, you know, they need to be noticed that these are now going to be allowed, even though your contract says it's not allowed, and that And until we do update your contract, we're not going to enforce what's in the contract related to this. And then number two is around actually updating the contracts within 2 years after the effective date of this rule.
Well, isn't most of the effort incurred here under this notice the appraisal of your current contracts to identify provisions which potentially contravene paragraph A? Wouldn't a much less effortful, if that's a word, approach be to notify all your clients that these are the rules, and any clauses which contravene that, these are the rules? Let legals draft it.
Yeah.
You're drafting a
right.
common notice to everybody. You don't have
Andy,
to go
I
through
actually
and actually
think that. Customer contracts are, well, I do think customers were likely to have questions. That's a more straightforward question than the
questions.
The third party contracts. There are some types of contracts that a health IT developer will have with third parties that are not implicated by these provisions, right? So if a health IT developer contracts with an auditor to look at their finances, they could presumably have whatever confidentiality language they want to with the auditor who's going to look at their finances. That's not something that's restricted by these provisions. But if you have a third-party contract with an entity where their scale is going to be incorporated into your software, that might have to be revised per the intellectual property of someone else piece. Or if there's a third-party contract with another system to say, hey, we had an NDA to say we were going to do some development work together, and we agreed to keep each other's stuff confidential as part of that, but now does that have to be revised because maybe we had a very broad term?
Absolutely. That's for the customer, the developer to ascertain. I'm just thinking that this whole B1 is all about the health IT developer doing something, both to a notice to their customers and to other parties they have agreements with, which could be third parties, it could be, you know, whatever. And it just seems that because the back half of B1 says those who have agreements containing provisions that contravene paragraph 8, well, if you took out that contravention piece, then actually this becomes a much more straightforward to comply with.
No, I don't think so.
Why not? Because you don't have to have someone going and appraising all the contracts, and you can have a standard notice, at least to your customers, that says, this is what the rules say, and this is our position on those rules.
I think one already permits a standard notice to customers. I think the tricky part is I don't think it's possible to do one standard notice to those with which it has agreements.
Look, I'm in the same boat you are, okay? And I'm thinking through how this would work. Mm-hmm. And it's not like every contract's the same.
Right.
I think we could do it. I think it could be done as a, I'm not going to speak for lawyers and we'll let legal people, but, you know, a blanket contractual amendment that puts these, says you, we will comply with these terms as prescribed in law, and where there is a conflict with anything in that contract, these terms will prevail or something like that. I could see that working.
I do think people would rely on standard language for many of these contracts, right? I think that would be common, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think really seriously most entities, I mean, the companies I've dealt with have a standard TNC boilerplate that they build around for all their contracts. And then things are negotiated. So I think I agree with Andy that this could be handled in a much more streamlined way and it would meet the intent of the law.
You do agree with me or you don't agree with me?
No, I do agree with you. Okay. I think we might be reading way too much into the what would have to occur here.
I think we're conflating one and two, right? I think, one, there's a variety of approaches. I think ONC even talks about potentially putting, like, a notice on your website, right? Two, I think, mandates an approach that individually goes back and has, like, a signed amendment to each.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. You're going to have to amend your contract.
Hang on. I and II or one and two?
One and two.
Number one, number two. Okay.
Correct. I think could be accomplished in a variety of ways, and some of them might be more work than others, and it seems to allow some amount of discretion as to how it would want to be approached by any individual developer. Two seems to require the more complicated approach of actually having an amendment signed in each case, which is estimated as zero effort, which I think is, we already put below that should be reestimated.
Well, you mean two II, right? Two
Correct.
II, I think, is fine. That's a perspective one. It's two II that says
two
we have to go
II
back.
Is what I mean.
Yeah, and you've got 2 years. Well, yeah, we all know that 2 years isn't reasonable because we have contracts that last 5, 10 years.
In this case, some cases 10 years, Aaron. Yeah, I mean, I agree with that.
Hey, Aaron, welcome back.
Thanks. I've been here for about 15 minutes listening, so, yep.
Going, well, I'm glad I left this conversation.
That gives them 2 years to amend every contract they have that has contravening language. That's not a lot of time.
No,
contracting is a slow process.
But I go back to my question I asked the other day: why 2 years? How did we come up with these duration of times? I don't understand. There's got to be a logic behind this. Why 2 years?
If you comply with number one and you comply with 2I, then why does it matter whether it's 2 years or 3 years, as long as you're complying with the other provisions?
I mean, the way I would say it is, you know, upon the next renewal, contract renewal date or whatever that is, because every contract eventually renews. So whatever that duration is, fine. At that point, you talk through it. But don't put it mandate at 2 years.
Yeah, let's recommend that, guys, because I think that is –
This is Lauren from ONC. I think you guys are all welcome to comment whatever you want to recommend. For a little bit of context, part of the reason why we might have recommended the two-year time frame was more from a compliance perspective to align with the two-year time frame for the implementation of a few of the other proposals in the rule, including the new API criterion as well as the new electronic health information export criterion, which are also proposed on a two-year time frame.
Okay,
but,
I understand the logic, Lauren.
But I think those are animals of a different thing, color, because these contracts are wholly different than implementation of development for APIs and so forth. I think by complying with one above and 2I here, I think there can be some flexibility here in terms of upon the next renewal of a contract. I think that's a whole different category of thing compared to the other items that have a two-year time frame in the rules. But I appreciate your explanation as to why you believe ONC did it that way.
Yeah, Denise, I think we should probably help ONC with a bit of a taking their calculations and just actually putting it into some of our specific situations. You know, as a large-scale implementer of health IT systems, you know, contracts typically take, let's say, between 2 and 6 months to negotiate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's just call it 4 in the middle because it makes the math easier. And let's say at any moment in time, we probably have between 300 and 400 extant contracts. That's a lot of time to shoehorn into 2 years.
Well, so this is Aaron. Let me ask this question. Is it? I can appreciate what Lauren said, and I don't want to get away from the spirit of what ONC is attempting to do by. You know, almost co-terming all their provisions to be at the same time. What if we come up with a middle ground, like within 2 years, the health IT vendor community will look at all of their customers and have a timeline to when each of these contracts will need to be amended so that, you know, you have a two-year mark that suddenly they have a watermark of, okay, these 10,000 customers, we know when their contracts are going to redo, so we could provide that list upon demand of, hey, we need to include this provision. So at least within 2 years, you're showing intent of goodwill to follow and adhere to the rule. I mean, that's kind of a middle ground here.
That's interesting. Maybe if you updated 2I to also say that it's establish, enforce, or renew any contract or agreement.
Yeah, something like that, something in the middle, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, again, we can go back to the intent. I do respect and really appreciate the good work that's gone into even putting something out there to float. But I don't want to cause undue burden to the community. Sasha, what do you think?
So the proposal is to add or renew to 2I and then remove the time frame expectation in II.
That's right. Well, the time frame would be within 2 years, you have a list of all your customers and you know when you're going to be renewing. So whether a contract expires in 5 years or 1 year or 3 years, you could at least provide that and show evidence towards, yeah, we're waiting for that renewal in 3 years and we're going to add this provision as part of it at that time.
So we would revise II to say that instead?
Yes. Something to that, yeah, language like that, yes.
Well, state a roadmap in 2 years with the date inside the roadmap for compliance not to be unfeasible,
yeah,
or something like that.
That's exactly right. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know the right legalese, but yeah, something like that.
I'm capturing this here, and then we're sort of proposing... Is that kind of the capture it in the edits?
Oh, don't capture it in the text at the top, because
I'll put it down below.
Is,
okay. Yeah.
I'll put it down below already.
Oh, you did. Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's okay. I quite like this collaboration approach. It's good.
I do too. I think it's very engaging and much easier than
everyone working in the isolation.
Exactly. Yes. Or when you start to send emails around and have like 40 different slightly nuanced drafts proliferating.
And when you're chairing a task force and have to compile it all into one document. Yeah, I agree completely. Okay. We've staggered to the end of maintenance of certification. Are we all comfortable with where we're at right now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
We are going to have to come back to communication.
Yep.
As we've asked ONC. And Mark will look for the next meeting for you to do a readout on those in the first 20 minutes so we can get to grips with this again.
Yeah. So, Andy, this is Denise, and you wanted to know where enforcement was. It starts on page 304 of the preamble.
I get that. I'm more looking inside the actual regs document.
Oh.
It's 170.580.
580, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's
a
different title. ONC Review of Certified Health IT or Health IT's Developers Actions. Got it.
Are we
Thank
skipping
you.
The questions that are in the Google Doc because we've kind of addressed them earlier, or did we want to talk about those?
Which,
I think we mostly talked about them.
Do you mean the request for comment?
Yes. I'm reading them over now. I think we did discuss most of them already.
Oh, we have.
We're
especially number
advanced.
5. Yeah. Well, no, it just means ONC preempted everything that we'd actually discussed. I'm happy to move to subpart E.
It's nice to know that we were thinking somewhat logically.
No. We were just all thinking the same. It doesn't mean we were logical or not.
Good job.
Okay. 175.80. ONC Review of Certified Health IT or Health IT Developers Actions.
Yeah, so if I can provide some commentary here,
please
I
do.
Think the reason why there's not regulation text the way that you would see for the other sections is because what we're proposing to do is amending a section of the regulation text that already exists today for ONC Direct Review of Certified Health IT and using a process that we've already finalized previously in 2016 in the Enhanced Oversight and Accountability Final Rule for ONC to directly review certified health IT for certain concerns such as patient safety issues and use that same process with a few modifications to also enforce developer compliance with the conditions and maintenance of certification requirements, which is basically what I think what the text right here just says. So, we can pull up the electronic code of federal regulations so you can see what 175.80 looks like today, but it would not reflect the right what the regulation text would look like if we were to finalize the minor modifications to the process that are proposed for engaging with developers to work on compliance.
Okay, because in the preamble you've got table 3, which does seem to go a bit. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, page 304 through 322.
I put table 3 into the Google Doc for reference.
Please do. It's a picture. That's why. I was like, how the heck did she get that in?
I took a screenshot.
Well, I don't know. I tried to paste the text and it all went pear shaped. So I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. So this is certainly. Is OSC trying to discourage us from discussing this?
Sorry, could you repeat that, Andy?
Are you trying to discourage us from discussing this?
I'm sorry, I missed that again.
Okay. Are you trying to discourage us from discussing
this? No,
not discourage you from discussing it. Happy to answer any questions for background.
Well, it's just that this table actually seems pretty. This is an interesting one, this table. You know, it depends on how militant we feel about whether you want to give absolute rights of appeal or not.
I'll leave that up to you all. But I guess maybe to give you some more context, for the process that exists today, ONC's purview for directly reviewing health IT is only limited to the health IT, the certified health IT itself. And in today's world, we can only suspend or terminate the certificate of the certified health IT itself. And if we were to do that in today's world, a developer could appeal that decision. The sort of nuance with the addition of the conditions and maintenance of certification requirements is that there are requirements that are both about the certified health IT itself, and then, as you know well, a developer's behaviors, actions, and business practices. And so a slight difference that we're proposing is that if we were to find a developer in noncompliance with a condition or maintenance of certification requirement, if there is a tie back to the certified health IT, we could take the option to terminate the certificate, but in all cases, if there is a noncompliance with the condition of certification, we would ban the developer from the certification program, as you see in the table here. And so there could be one, two, or three possible outcomes, and depending on what that outcome is, a developer could appeal any of those decisions in our proposed approach.
Can I ask for clarification about the ban? Is that a broad ban where they're banned from getting any of their product certified?
Correct.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. That would be...
Yeah, wow. That's... Wow, okay. I mean, I get the point of the seriousness of this. I mean, I appreciate that. But as a CIO, there's some vendors out there with, 100 products. You know, one may not conform, but does that mean the entire kitchen sink is bad? I don't know.
Sure.
But
so,
isn't that an extreme, though, that you can ban, you can prohibit modules from being released, but you don't have to disband the entire vendor?
So, yes, I think to answer that question really quickly, and then I'll shut up and let you all discuss, that is in an extreme case. As you see here, we would first, and we state this in the preamble, want to work with the developer through corrective action to remedy the noncompliance. So that is our first and foremost priority. So we're not trying to go to the last action as the first option, But, you know, in a few cases, you know, if through working through the corrective action we find that the noncompliance cannot be remedied or the developer is not responsive, you know, or there are a few other reasons, then, you know, that is sort of the stick, if you will, to encouraging compliance. And 21st Century Cures does say that ONC has the authority to encourage compliance with the conditions and maintenance of certification requirements in, you know, the way that it sees fit. And then to the ban, a developer may work with ONC to request and seek what we call remediation, so that, you know, ONC may sort of reapprove a developer to re-enter the program after, you know, it's proposed and completed some kind of remediatory action that ONC finds is satisfactory to fix the problem and make customers whole again. So I'll just say those two things and then let you guys discuss.
So I just one thing I'd like to say concerning the ban, and Aaron's reaction, my reaction as well, is if you have a very large health IT vendor that has several hundred products that a health system uses, and the EHR and around the interoperability, they have behavior that would result in a ban, that could have some serious implications for the health system for products that really aren't even related to the particular issue. So I just want to have you say again and clarify. You did say that the ban is for any certification of any products which they offer, not just the product that's
I think she said that's like a final straw, that if that one product doesn't conform, then they can go back and have a further stick to really say, I mean it, we're going to ban everything, and then they can.
Okay.
That's what I heard Lauren say.
And I assume, Lauren, that is not something that is something that a lot of things would have to not happen for ONC to consider doing that.
Yeah, right.
It's a big
you're right.
stick.
It's not the first action, no.
Yes, there's a whole flow of notices that we would send the developer in advance of any of that happening. So there would be plenty of steps prior to any of that happening, and that would involve a lot of work between ONC and the developer.
Yeah, the one thing I'm seeing, and Lauren, I appreciate that clarification. Thank you. The one thing I think as a customer of all these different vendors and some very large vendors is, how do I become aware that, A, I have a vendor that's being non-compliant, and then, B, that there is a consideration for a larger enforcement because this vendor's not being, not being forthright and helping to remediate. I guess I would say that as every stage is escalated with a vendor that's behaving badly, we'll just use that terminology, I would wish that there was some sort of messaging to the community saying, hey, FYI, vendor X, Y, and Z is just completely run amok, and we're having to continue. Just some awareness, because if I need to make a decision and change strategy of using a product, that's, easily 12, 24 months at a minimum to make that happen without impacting patients.
So to your point, yes, we talk about this in the preamble of this rule and also refer back to our old rules. That's what we like to do. We like to make you go read our old rules. that we would intend to post any approved corrective action plans between ONC and the developer publicly on the CHAPL, our Certified Health IT Product List, as we do today. If we were to undertake direct review, we would put that CAP, corrective action plan, on the CHAPL, and we do that today. The ACBs, the certification bodies that perform surveillance on our certified products, post those corrective action plan summaries of them on the CHAPL. So that is one way. We have a couple of sort of quick tabs on the CHAPL on the homepage. One of them is for banned developers, so you could quickly go and see who might be banned. You could also go and see which products and developers are currently under corrective action, et cetera. So that's one method, which is kind of passive. I think in the corrective action plan itself, one of the proposed elements of that corrective action plan before ONC would approve it is how the developer plans to notify all affected customers of, you know, the problem and what the proposed solution is, as well as the time frame for resolving the problem.
Ah, got it. So it worked almost like okay. So it worked like a confidentiality integrity agreement that like the OCR would give to a covered entity saying, hey, you've got 2 years to fix all these EPHI issues or HIPAA issues, and that's posted to the world. So the same kind of process would follow here for a vendor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Now I got it. Thank you.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I read through 304 through 323, I mean, I thought it was fairly complete and a judicious, fair stepwise process that started out light and then gets firm at the end. So I personally didn't have any suggested changes or comments. Now that the ban's been explained, that was my big question.
Yeah. Now that I understand the process, that's fair, right? I mean, I think we need to have a fair process. I think absent a process, that stinks because then no one will do anything. Too arduous a process will just discourage any kind of developer from being innovative. But a fair process ensures compliance, and I feel this is fair.
And the process is not unlike what the health IT vendors are presently accustomed to working within.
Right. The only thing I don't see on here, which is I don't know if it's for us to even debate this, is with some of the vendors that have acted really badly, is sort of remediation of some sort to their customers. So, and in this case, I'm thinking of one major vendor that paid back. Yes.
Yeah. The next section, which is certification ban, the section D of that is reinstatement.
Ah. There you go.
So we're going to get to that in the fullness of time.
Let's do it.
Okay. Just a question, Lauren. Just as a broad brushstroke, how many vendors have experienced some kind of ONC sanction?
When you mean sanction, do you mean by us initiating direct review?
Yeah, let's start with direct review, and then let's work through the cone that gets to the and how many have been banned at the very end. So how many have had direct review?
So on the Chapel, we have never posted an approved corrective action plan between us and a developer. Andy, I alluded to the certification bodies, right? They're the ones that actually issue the certificates, because we have a third-party testing and certification program, so we're more of the oversight body. And so typically in non-compliance issues with the certified health IT, it's the certification bodies that work with the developers through corrective action and remedying those issues. And I don't have a number off the top of my head.
Okay, I appreciate it's the certification bodies. I'm just looking to see, under the auspices of the coded rules from 2016, how many have actually had direct actually how many have been taken through the process? If you can find that out for next time, I think that will help us just with some of our considerations.
So none.
Okay. So and Andy, the big distinction here is and probably why she's saying there's none is because ONC hasn't needed to get into a direct review situation because the certifying bodies have handled this, because the current process looks at the health IT module, not the behavior. They don't have any authority around the behavior that the conditions of certification and maintenance now provide under the CARES Act, which ONC has authority to act on. And in fact, in the preamble, it goes into some details about what the certifying bodies will continue to do related to the IT modules versus what ONC will do related to behaviors and business practices of the health IT vendors. That's where the big difference is.
But the enhanced oversight and accountability rule, it changed ONC's role and gave them the ability for direct review. I know they haven't used it, but they felt they needed it.
Under very limited circumstances, and the limited circumstances were namely when there was a reasonable belief that the certified health IT may be causing or contributing to serious risks to public health or safety.
Yep.
Or suspected nonconformity.
So can I ask an elementary type question here? And this is just my unawareness. How does this now cross the line with what the FTC does from a deceptive practices perspective? Doesn't this begin to blur the lines a little bit on who holds whom accountable? Or is there clear enough delineation here?
Lowen?
Well, I guess I can chime in here. Can you hear me? What I was going to say is, our authority specific, what we're talking about is has to do with certified health IT products and the program. I mean, we can't really speak to what FTC, what their authority is, I think it's possible that they could investigate a similar situation that we are, but we can only speak to our authorities.
So thank you, and I can appreciate that. So in theory, I just want to make sure everybody on this call is aware of that theoretically, if there is a situation with someone behaving badly, again, hopefully that will never happen, but assume an extreme case, it is the realm of possibility that ONC could have its sanctions, including a ban, and FTC and or other agencies could step in from their respective domain and do what they need to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's not mutually exclusive in any way. I mean, Lauren, feel free to jump in, but I believe FTC is free to investigate, whatever they want to investigate, and we would look at the certified product the conduct here. In this case, the conduct, not the product, but yeah, or both, potentially.
Another example of somewhat overlapping authority, which we talk about in the rule, is in the specific case of information blocking. So, the HHS Office of the Inspector General was also given authority in the 21st Century Cures Act to enforce information blocking that may be performed by health IT developers and then also providers and other actors, health information exchanges, et cetera. And so from the perspective of the conditions and maintenance of certification, I want to clarify that ONC's authority here is just limited to health IT developers that have certified products under the health IT certification program for information blocking. That isn't to say that, OIG may not also have authority over both the health IT developer as well as these other actors that may be found information blocking. So that's another example of multiple agencies having maybe somewhat of an overlap of authority, but maybe different investigatory approaches and possible different outcomes of an investigation.
Yep, that totally makes sense. Thank you.
Just one other clarification, though, as far as information blocking more broadly, we did have FTC review our proposals, and again, not talking about the conditions of certification, but speaking more broadly about information blocking, we were very clear with FTC, and they wanted to be clear that their the laws that they're under are separate from what we're doing, and the standards for information blocking, for instance, for RAND licensing, things like that, would be different than standard antitrust laws. And our authority comes from CURES. Theirs is different. So it's a different scope there.
Yep. I just mean in the realm of all things extreme, again, the far edge case, there could be circumstances of overlapping jurisdiction. I just want to make sure I understood that in my head correctly. So I appreciate you guys.
Definitely. Yep, for sure.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. After that, discussion. I'm just going to take the opportunity now in a brief lull to open for public comments, Seth.
If you would like to make a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press *2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment, please.
And operator, do we have any comments in the queue at this time?
There are no public comments at this time.
Okay. All right, we can pick up where we left off.
Love it. Thank you. Okay, guys. Do we have any comments to make on this?
So while these are thinking, there are a couple of requests for comment, I believe, in the section. I'm not sure if they were pulled into the template.
Yeah, I pulled one in that says we solicit comment on the nature and types of nonconformities. And we also solicit comment on whether the type of notice should affect the method of correspondence. Those we can consider.
So I did note this proposal. ONC says in general they would communicate with HIT developers over email. It seems to me that a specific correspondence of significance should, as it does in the other process for enforcement, be delivered by certified mail to avoid the consequence of it being overlooked.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree.
Well, to that point, I believe we talk about this more in the direct review rule, but email is the default, I believe, under the correspondence. And I believe we write in the preamble, though, that we're able to have discretion based on the significance and type of situation. I can find that language, but I think there is discretion, but the default is email.
Which, I mean, I think the tricky part is that developers would want to rely on that discretion being exercised for a communication of significance.
I'm going to try to find that preamble language real quick, but go on.
I think it's on 309.
Yeah, so Sasha's right. We pointed to 17505, where Mark was right that by default our method of communication is email, and that's what we're proposing for use in the direct review process, but we are soliciting comment on it. So if that's the comment that you want to give back to ONC, again, that's up for you to decide.
So I guess my proposal for the group to consider would be that for notices of potential nonconformity, suspension, proposed termination, and termination, certified mail should be delivered.
Or both. Or just do both. I mean, email and certified mail. Just do both.
Sure. That would be
fine. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, you want to make sure that the developer had every opportunity to get wind and remediate and deal with. And, I mean, it's only fair, right? So I think both. Mm-hmm. Send a three-eyed raven if you need to. Just do something.
So let's recommend that.
I must confess, it feels like the registered mail approach is in conjunction with electronic mail.
Yes, both.
Yeah, that's what we're suggesting.
Yeah, but it's not like every correspondence has to be through it. So it needs to be, you know, correspondence of a certain level. Now, to know that you've been put under this direct approach from ONC, that notice, absolutely. But every piece of correspondence and backwards and forwards seems a little bit over the top.
I think that's fine.
Think
do you think
Sasha
I worded it okay,
referring.
Andy?
Well, one at a time, sorry.
I was just going to say that. I think Sasha was referring to those major notices.
Okay. I worded that in our proposal. I have it now on under 580 still, unless we should move it somewhere else.
Let's have a look. No, this is we should, I think. It's more than just potential for me. It's actually what do they call it? The direct review.
That do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this is good. I like that proposal.
Yeah. And the nature and types of nonconformities. Now, I imagine that what the intent is that any non-conformity with any aspect of this proposed rule could warrant ONC to intervene. Is that everybody else's understanding?
I believe so, yes. I mean, I think ONC reserves a judgment depending on severity, but yes, they could always intervene.
Yep. I think this is quite important because certainly some of the other calls which are going on at the moment, there's the, well, we need to lay down the guidance for OIG to follow, etc. Well, actually, it's not just OIG, it's ONC as well.
Right.
So maybe a little bit of context here. I believe Denise who was talking about this earlier, that the sort of triggers for direct review today are different from what we're proposing under noncompliance with the conditions and maintenance of certification requirements. So under direct review today, one of the two major triggers is, a severe threat to patient health or safety. Whereas, as an example, one of the conditions of certification that Congress mandated is that developers have to attest to ONC that they are meeting the conditions and maintenance of certification requirements. And I believe we are proposing that developers attest to ONC every 6 months of that. So using that as an example, if there are a number of developers who miss their every 6 month timeframe to attest to ONC, should ONC also send notices of nonconformity to them through certified mail, as opposed to if there is suspicion of an information blocking noncompliance with the conditions of certification. So, I think the point is that there are more conditions and maintenance of certification requirements, and they may vary in the perceived frequency, severity of the type of noncompliance. And so the question is should the perceived severity and frequency of the type of noncompliance affect how ONC communicates with a health IT developer?
And just as a little bit more background, when we were thinking about it in the context of direct review, we were trying to weigh, the expediting, especially if it's an issue of public health and safety, making sure the notice gets out quickly so it can be addressed. And also, a paper copy.
Mark, you're breaking up, or is it just me?
Oh, yeah, it's probably me. A paper copy might be better in some situations. So, it's just that balance is what I wanted to say. So we thought about it, but I think your feedback would be very helpful on that.
Well, just the conditions of certification, which is section 406 off the top of my head, that's not in our scope for this group, is it?
Conditions
some of them
are in, yeah, you have talked,
some
I think are. You have talked about information blocking assurances in the communications, which are the first three of the six, and the one of the other task forces is talking about the other three, which are the APIs, real world testing, and attestation conditions.
Yep.
So I guess the idea is, I know you haven't talked about the latter three, but knowing that there are six conditions of certification, each of which have their own specific conditional and maintenance requirements, which may vary, and that we're proposing to use one standardized sort of direct review process for noncompliance with all of those. Does that affect sort of the way that ONC should communicate with health IT developers?
Yeah, this is Aaron. I still stand behind doing both modalities. That's just my vote for this group, email and snail mail. Because that way you get the immediacy with email, but you get the assuredness that they definitely got the certified mail on the heels of it.
Just a note that it's from a legal standpoint, it would be important to clarify potentially when notice occurs. If you send out both, you know, clarifying if it's when the email comes or when the written notice comes, or just maybe talking through that could be helpful for the recommendation.
Yeah, so what we say in 17505 is that when we send certified mail, the official date of, you know, when the clock starts is the date of the delivery confirmation to the address on record. So that would be the date of confirmation, delivery confirmation of the snail mail, the certified mail method.
I think that's what should be used, because, you know, the problem with email and the volume of email people get, I just think we're leaving a lot to chance by using that as the date.
I agree, and who knows what gets caught in a spam filter or whatever else. I mean,
yeah.
I am curious. Sasha, what do you think?
About when the clock should start when doing both methods?
No, the modality of communication.
The modalities and the clock. I say both questions there.
I think that when an important, significant communication is being issued, we need a degree of reliability that's greater than email.
Yep.
To start a clock. So I agree that in casual context, email is fine. I think I would be willing to try to draw lines around, you know, some amount of issuing reminders about not having submitted your stuff by a deadline over email. But I guess at the same time, if that reminder is starting a clock that limits the, you know, the process that eventually could go towards a ban, maybe it does merit the more significant communication.
Well, that might be the parameter to use then, Sasha, is if it starts a clock, that kind of communication would have its date based on the mail, the snail mail delivery receipt.
It avoids challenges of, you know, particular staff being on vacation or out on medical leave or buried in an inbox and missing something that could be very significant.
Yeah, you know, the other thing I don't know is on the laundry list of all the HIT certified products, what email address is captured? Like, is it the email address of a generic inbox? Is it the email address? I mean, I think it's the small developers. They may have, like, you know, Aaron at abccompany.com. I mean, if Aaron is in Africa on a safari for 3 weeks, well, gee.
Or Aaron no longer works there, and no one's
right.
Reading the mail.
Well, he definitely won't be if he doesn't answer this email. I think there's a conversation that's around timeliness and authoritativeness that we're blushing around here. So something that's sent to the registered address by registered email, that's got the authoritativeness around it. The email has a timeliness because it's almost instant that you know you've dispatched it, but you don't know when anyone's read it. And depending on the level of urgency, I can actually see that, you know, putting a phone call and speak to whoever you know is in charge at that company and say, this is happening, guys. But the phone call will be followed up by an email, which will be followed up by the certified mail. Those three have to happen or would happen together, not have to. You see my point there, that there's, if it's really truly urgent, then you should treat it as truly an urgent.
Yeah. Okay. Are we at time, or I'm just curious?
We are at time.
We are at time.
Great discussion.
In positive news is we're actually on target and on cadence, which I'm given to believe slightly through the back channels that not all the task forces are.
Oh, now wait a minute. The task force I'm co-chairing, we're on target. Have a little competition here.
Of course. Healthy is good. Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Well, congratulations if your task force was also on target, and thank you for participating in this one as well.
You're welcome. Thank you to everybody.
Cheers. Okay, great guys. Discussion, everybody.
Thanks.
Appreciate you.
Thanks for your time today. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.